First, I'd like to thank Leslie for helping to organize the event, and thank you all for coming. This is the issue of why people go off to DARA is a very complicated and very controversial issue. It's an issue that everyone seems to have an opinion about, whether right or wrong. There are many, many different reasons that people go off the DARA, and they're about as varied and as complex as each of us are as individuals. What makes this particularly difficult to understand in some cases is that oftentimes the people themselves who have gone off the DARA don't know why they have. I interviewed one girl who I spoke to for about 3 hours who told me first it was her family and then it was her community and then it was her school. And at the end of 3 hours she said, you know, I guess you could say I really don't know why I went off the DARA. I guess you could say I'm confused. Experts alike have many different opinions, and often they tend to see things through their own particular lens. Drug counselors will point to drug abuse, and teachers will point to the educational system, and oftentimes people just sort of finger point. The teachers will say, it's not us, it's the parents, and the parents will say, it's not us, it's the teachers. And by the time you get to the end of it, it seems to be really confusing, and with very good reason. Even understanding how big of a problem this really is problematic. There have currently been no studies that have been done that sort of look at the population on a national level. I guess in the first place, even identifying what does Orthodox or observant mean would be tricky. The National Jewish Population Survey, which was done taking a look at Judaism and Jewish life in America across the board, doesn't even define orthodoxy as halachic orthodoxy, as we would. So even understanding really how big the issue is problematic. In the book, I suggest a couple of different ways of maybe looking at it to kind of try to extrapolate how big of a phenomenon it is. One thing I'd like to share with you, which I think kind of puts this in a very surprising light, it's sort of a way to extrapolate how big of an issue it is that when you take a look at the Jewish world today, we really see something which we've never seen before in Jewish history. Today, at least in America, about 90% of the Orthodox Jewish world is not observant. And that's a phenomenon that really has never happened before. Prior to the Enlightenment, the number of Jews who were not observant were so small that they could hardly be counted. Today, we see a completely different reality. And you have to ask the question, where did all of these non-observant Jews come from? If just a couple of hundred years ago, the number of Jews who were unobservant were so small they couldn't be counted, how did we go from that to 90%? And the answer really is that these non-observant Jews, if you go back 3-4 generations, came from observant families. What often happens is that one person from an observant home takes a step off the derech, so to speak. The next generation moves one step farther away, until the fourth and fifth generation you have intermarriage. It's kind of like in the Pesach Seder, in the Haggadah, there is, when we talk about the four sons, there's an explanation of the story of the four sons, which says really we shouldn't look at these as four sons, but rather as four generations. The first generation is the Chacham, so to speak. They are most connected to our Jewish heritage and most committed to it. The second generation is the rebel. The rebel moves away. He does the exact opposite of what his parents did. And he is, so to speak, the evil son or the wicked son. The third generation is simple. They are kind of confused between the grandparents who were committed and the parents who were completely uncommitted. And by the time you get to the fourth generation, the child doesn't even know how to ask a question anymore because he's so far removed. And the fifth generation, unfortunately, the fifth generation is not even at the Pesach Seder anymore. And that's why there are only four sons. In the same way, we sort of see this intergenerationally, that when someone sort of moves away from observance, often, if that trend continues, 3-4 generations, no more, that observant link is completely severed, and there could even be intermarriage. So this trend of people going off the derech, which has been increasing over the past generations, no matter how big or small it is, if you want to say it's 1% or if you want to say it's 50%, has ultimately led to this new reality in the Jewish world, which is very astounding and is very new. It seems the only thing that we really can sort of agree on is that whatever the numbers are, they are increasing, And whatever the age or the definition of the population of people who have gone off the derech was, the age of these people are decreasing. We're seeing more and more teenagers or preteens, even 11, 12, 13-year-olds, who are sort of moving away from observance. It's worth asking the question, hasn't it always been this way? It seems almost as if, as long as there has been a derech, people have been going off of it. So is there really cause for alarm? And I think the answer is that no, it really hasn't always been this way, and perhaps there is cause for alarm. When you look historically at our Jewish history, we have basically been a people who has almost always been persecuted. And persecution does two things. It both kills the desire to assimilate, and it kills the opportunity to assimilate. When the outside world is hostile, you don't particularly want to join it and leave your own world, and even if you did, it's not necessarily so easy to do so. So we really didn't see all that much assimilation throughout Jewish history. The times that you did see assimilation was when there were moments of freedom. But those moments of freedom happened in punctuated moments in time. There were not, you know, long time periods of stretches where you saw freedom and mass assimilation. Things really changed with the Enlightenment. With the Enlightenment, there was a new philosophy sort of in the world. The world was no longer God-centric. It was much more man-centric and science-centric and reason-centric. Freedom was now a new reality. It wasn't a simply punctuated moment. And by punctuated moments, it could be 100 years, let's say, which in the span of a 2,000-3,000-year history is a moment, so to speak. And as a result of this, the numbers grew dramatically. In our generation, we see even something more different, which is that the numbers are even greater than they have been in the last couple of hundred years, and the nature of defection is also different than it has been. In the first place, we see children and people in their 20s and 30s who no longer seem to struggle to hold on to their Judaism. As Rabbi Ephraim Buchwald said, our parents seem to hold on to Judaism with some sort of mystical zeal, and our children seem to give it away for a pot of lentils. That is something very different, not to sort of struggle to hold on to our Jewish identity. And now we do see people in their teens who are moving away from observance, and this too is something new. You used to sort of see parents or grandparents who maybe had to stop keeping Shabbos when they moved to America because they needed to get a job to support their families. Now you see teenagers who seemingly have everything you would think they would need to have in order to maintain their observance who are moving away. So things are somewhat different, really, than they ever have been. And when you look at it in light of this reality of 90% of the observant Jewish world, at least in America, not being observant anymore, not 90% of the Jewish world not being observant, there really is cause for alarm. So why is this happening? First, it's worth mentioning and discussing a little bit why this is not happening and dispelling some of the myths. First, people do not go off the derech because of freedom. Freedom is not the cause of defection. Freedom is merely the condition that allows for defection. Freedom is inherently a neutral thing. The real question is what we do with the freedom that we have. It does not make our choices for us. It simply gives us an environment in which we can choose. So that is not to say that freedom doesn't play a role in people going off the derech. Freedom very much does play a role in people going off the derech. What it does, though, is that it sort of levels the playing field, and it raises the bar for Judaism. When we live in a world where the outside world is free and accepting of us, Judaism now needs to be, in that kind of world, much better than it ever has been in any previous generation. In previous generations, when Judaism was compared to the alternative, and the alternative was threatening or menacing or evil, in that situation, Judaism really doesn't need to be all that much better to be seen as the way to go. In our world, when the outside world is attractive and when there is freedom, and the outside world has so much to offer, Judaism really needs to be much better than it ever has been. Likewise, you can't say really that people go off the derech because of the outside world or because of the Yetzer Hara, which seems to be very popular reasons to be given for why people do go off. That's not to say that nobody has ever pulled away because there is something attractive in the outside world. But in general, the vast majority of people have a vested interest in following the lifestyle and the Judaism that they've been raised with. You know, we sort of have the first shot with our children. Our children are born into our world. They have the strongest emotional connection to us. And because of that, they really do have the vested interest to sort of continue in the path that we raise them with. When we say that someone goes off the derech because of the outside world, it's somewhat similar to saying a man perhaps commits adultery because of another woman. It is true that in certain situations, men do commit adultery because of another woman. But in many cases, perhaps most cases, a wedge sort of needs a crack. When there is adultery, often when you look at the marriage itself, you see certain issues, you see certain problems that open the door for such behavior to happen. It doesn't explain all cases, but it probably explains most of them. So you can't really say that the outside world sort of pulled someone away. The real question is, what opened the door for that person to be pulled away to begin with? Likewise, with the Yetzirah, when the Yetzirah is at play, you tend to see a struggle. You know, when the Yetzirah is sort of working on something, you see people struggling to sort of hold on to, you know, Shabbos, or to not speak Lashon Hara, or to give more tzedakah, or whatever it might be. With many, or most of these people you see who have gone off the derech, you don't see that struggle sort of happening, which kind of indicates that it's probably not the Yetzirah at play. In addition, when the Yetzirah is at play, you tend to see losses in moments in time. You see sometimes you win the battle to not speak Lashon Hara, and sometimes you lose it. But the losses are not across the board. They're not with all the mitzvot. They're not with people just completely going away. There was a documentary film called Trembling Before God. I don't know if any of you have seen it or not. It was about homosexuals in the Orthodox Jewish world. And this was a controversial movie for many different reasons. Many people were unhappy with the depiction of orthodoxy and felt that it was maybe not as accurate as it might be. But I found it interesting in one regard, and that's that these people, many of them, although they were struggling with homosexuality, which is, we are told, one of the stronger sort of yetzirahs out there, not homosexuality, but sexual things in particular, they were really struggling to hold on to Shabbat and to Kashrut and to put on tefillin and to daven. It's not that because they had this desire in one particular area, they were throwing or willing to throw all of their observant life away. Quite the contrary. Although they had this Yetzirah in a very difficult area in life, in fact, one that would create ostracism in their communities and create huge problems for them, they struggled very hard to hold on to whatever they could hold on to. And I think that's a very interesting and very important sort of example of, you know, when you really love Judaism or are committed to it, a Yetzirah for a particular thing is not necessarily going to take you off the derech altogether. So the outside world, the Yetzirah, these things really are where defection ends. It's not where defection begins. So where does defection begin? Why do people go off the derech? I realized in starting to prepare my speech that really any one area that I would speak about would be lacking, because the real trick in understanding this issue is understanding the myriad of causes that lead people to go off the derech, then understanding which of those causes are most important and least important, and then lastly being able to relate those issues to particular individuals, because none of these things works in a vacuum. They all work with who we are as people, and we are all unique individuals with different strengths and weaknesses. So any one particular thing that I would talk about really almost undermines the whole issue at large. Having said that, there are a few different principles we can talk about, and there's one thing in particular, one issue in particular I'd like to discuss. You could say in general that people go off the derech because when compared to the alternative, Judaism sort of pales, and observant life pales in comparison. That's one way of looking at it. In most cases, it seemed that people were not running to the outside world, but rather they were running away from our own. And the things that caused them to go off the derech were experiences that they had within the observant world. To put it somewhat harshly, but I think accurately, you could say that religious people go off the derech because of religious people, and because of their experiences with the religious world. Those negative experiences create negative feelings toward Yiddishkeit itself. And when we have negative experiences with the film world in whatever capacity, it really colors how we feel toward observance and observant life. And that, more than anything else, our relationships with observant people, the experiences that we have in the religious world, really affect our religious choices, it seems, more than anything else. Which is not to say that belief doesn't play a part, whether or not we think that Judaism is true, it does. But more than anything else, our emotional experiences and relationships with religious people is what is the primary culprit. I'd like to share a couple of stories with you and read a couple of things from the book, which I think will portray at least one of the most important themes in this area. One person I spoke to, I call her Chani Metzger, had an experience where when she was in Beis Yaakov, she was maybe 14, 15 years old, and she came from a properly very firm home, and she was maybe having some issues at home that, you know, was maybe made her a little bit rebellious, not even really so rebellious, if you can call it. Maybe she was just a normal, curious teenager. But at the time, you know, the school, the Beis Yaakov, was a pretty, pretty strict one, and they were not allowed to watch any movies at all. And she went out on one weekend, and she watched the movie Revenge of the Nerds. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this movie. You know, not the worst movie in the world, not the best movie in the world. Okay, she's a 14, 15-year-old girl, not such a big deal, so she thought. After the weekend, she came into the school, and her teacher, who was also the principal of the school, had caught wind of this situation, and as she walked into the classroom, said, "P.U., open the windows. It smells like bad mice in here. Chani Metzger, go to the back of the room." Now, for a 14, 15-year-old girl who's engaging in what some would call fairly innocent behavior, this was, needless to say, particularly devastating. So much so that when discussing the issue of going off the derech some 20 years later, this stands out as one of the more painful experiences. There were many people I spoke to who had similar sorts of stories. One whom I call David really didn't know why he had gone off the derech. When I asked him, he was sort of all over the place about it. And he said that right away he really didn't like anything to do with the religion because of his rabbis. When I asked him what he meant, he told me that, for example, he went on. So his stories went on for 3 hours, one after another after another. The first thing he mentioned was that he used to walk to school with this girl, and he was told on to the principal, and the principal called him in the office and sort of chewed him out for this until he found out that the girl was his cousin, at which point the principal felt really foolish, and David felt that the principal was a real fool for having not even looked into the situation. He said his schoolmates were no better. He says other religious kids would attack me because I would talk to the girls in sixth grade. The older guys would call me names and hit me, shagets, shkuts. To make matters worse, he was Sephardic, but the other students were Ashkenazi, white people, he calls them, who were mostly from more religious homes. He remembers them calling him Schwarza in the same breath that he recalls being hit on the knuckles by his teacher when he was bad. When he thinks about religion now, he has a fairly negative attitude toward halacha, and toward his teachers, who he feels were fairly ignorant. And he says that when he thinks of his education, what he thinks is more representative of his education was a tape of Gehenna that he heard in second grade. As he explains, basically they shut off the lights and there was music in the background and people were screaming things like, "Oy vey, I'm hanging from my tongue. If only I wouldn't have spoken Lashon Hara." His negative memories continued for the three-hour interview. He explains that he played ball in Brooklyn with other local Jews. They were very religious, but they were liberal. And for the 10 or 15 years that he played softball there, a local father and daughter who were not Jewish joined them. Then he says, a chassid comes to play one game and leaves because a girl is playing. He tells the others that you're not allowed to play softball with girls. Now, probably according to the rules, you might not be, but there was no nagia, no attraction. She was almost 35. The father was 65. It was probably a big hill, Hashem, but the community caved in and kicked out the father and daughter. It made me feel really disgusted. Over time, the community moved religiously to the right, and there was increased infighting and disrespect between the various Orthodox groups. He remembers the Satmar and the Lubavitch fighting because one group wouldn't drink the other group's milk. He remembers Hasidim not liking the mechitza and sneaking in the middle of the night to raise it. David explained that no one put it back down because they were afraid of being perceived as less religious. After a long series of such experiences, David went to yeshiva in Israel. His second day there, a rav saw him missing class and said, "You're not learning, why don't you just leave?" Later in the year, when he went to visit his uncle for Shabbat, the school encouraged him not to go because the uncle was not religious. The uncle was having an operation, so David went. But he was made to feel like an outcast for it. Later in the year, David went to visit Rav Scheinberg, greatly respected rabbi, and a neighborhood kid asked him whom he had gone to visit, and when David said Rav Scheinberg, the kid said, "Oh, my father says he's a shiget." Now, what's interesting about his stories, when you listen to them, is that there seem to be so many different things. I mean, what is the common connection between all of these different issues? He sort of moves from one thing to another. When you think about it, there is a common thread that underlies all of these stories, and you could sum it up in one word. That word is rejection. He was rejected for walking to school with his cousin. He was rejected, or he felt rejected, when he was called a shvarta by his schoolmates and he was beaten up by them. He heard about rejection when he listened to the tape of Gehenna, which told him at the young age of 6 or 7 that God would reject him if he didn't keep the mitzvot. Every single story, even the experiences that have nothing to do with him, really revolve around rejection. The old man and his daughter who were rejected from the softball game. The mechitza, which was taken down, which represented the rejection of the community standards. The community caving in because they were afraid that they would be rejected. The different Hasidic sects not drinking each other's milk. The yeshiva's reaction to his uncle, who was not as religious as they would have liked to have been. And even Rav Scheinberg, who was rejected by a young child who was rejecting even before he was old enough to think for himself. Rejection really is the underlying theme, his story and Connie's story. And what is particularly interesting is, as the interview continued, it seemed that David learned over time that being a good Jew meant rejecting others and judging them. He says, "At my work, I'm the biggest Jew. The girl who was next to my office works on Yom Kippur, and she's dating a non-Jew. And I keep calling her shiksa and shkutz. Oh, look at the shiksa. And I'm friendly with her, and it's funny. And I happen to know this person, and I can see his joking around in that way actually being funny." But what's interesting is that this is the example he uses to prove that he's the biggest Jew. It seems like the bigger Jew you are, the more rejecting and the more rejecting language you use, which is a very, very sad lesson to have learned. And looking at his experiences, very easy to see why he would have learned that kind of lesson. Rejection was an issue that was brought up with many, many people I interviewed. In fact, I set up a website which surveyed over 600 people which responded to a survey. And the vast majority of them said that they had experienced rejection in their observant Jewish world. You might think, when you think about maybe more Haredi circles, this making a lot of sense, but the majority of people who responded to the online survey were from modern Orthodox communities, and they were saying that they experienced rejection in a very real way that was damaging to their observant life. This is really nothing new. Throughout history, rejection has been a theme which has caused people to go off the derech. In fact, the Gemara tells us that this might even have been a reason for Jesus going off the derech. We're told that Rabbi Yeshua ben Parathia apparently dismissed him and rejected him, and that was the beginning of his movement away. And it's very interesting to note, if that in fact is the case, Christianity, its main focus and themes in Christianity are unconditional love, acceptance, forgiveness, all things which sort of seem to be anti-rejection. So if in fact Jesus did go off the derech, so to speak, as a result of rejection, it's interesting and very informative to see how Christianity evolved into perhaps you know, into what it is today. This is not the first or last example of rejection. What people are experiencing now has been there for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. And it is perhaps one of the biggest reasons that people go off the derech today, I would say. Why is rejection and rejecting experiences such a big problem? It would seem that when children are born into our world, they really would want to do everything they can to gain our acceptance, and these sorts of things really should not be all that traumatic. On the contrary, there's very good reason for them being as traumatic as they are. There is a basic need to be accepted and to be loved. And the closer people are to us, the more important that need becomes. That need to be accepted and loved precedes even our religious needs and our spiritual needs. And when those needs are sabotaged, we sort of have to, almost, leave aside whatever it is that's getting in the way of our need to be loved and accepted. There's a psychologist, Abraham Maslow, a very famous psychologist, who has a theory that explains this very well. His theory is he explains that there's a hierarchy of needs in human life. We all have needs, but not all of our needs are equal to each other. Some needs are more fundamental than others. For example, we all have a need to feel safe, both physically and emotionally. But that need to feel safe is going to be a lot more important than, for example, our need to feel loved or our need for self-esteem. What happens when our need to feel safe is sabotaged or threatened? Everything else becomes unimportant. The only thing that becomes important to us is addressing that need to feel safe. And that takes precedence over everything else. So we can only move on to fulfilling our higher needs when we have actually achieved and fulfilled our lower needs. It's not 100% like that, but in principle, that, according to Dr. Maslow, that's the way that it works. The highest thing that he defines, our highest need, is to self-actualize. And that is really where our religious needs come in. Being religious, being observant, is not a matter of fulfilling a physiological need or a need to feel safe, although some people use religion to feel safe. Really, it's a matter of becoming the best of who we can be and reaching our potential. So when, for example, our need to feel accepted and loved is sabotaged, it jeopardizes our ability to move on to achieving self-actualization and achieving the best, becoming the best religious person that we can be. His theory really creates a very good model for understanding some of the biggest reasons that people go off the derech. What happens when those fundamental needs are not filled? What ensues is rebellion. And that rebellion does not necessarily happen as a matter of revenge against the parents or the community for having hurt them. In fact, rebellion can often be a matter of self-preservation. The way that, for example, a hand retracts from a hot oven or hot stove, when there's pain, you move away from it. And if the observant world is hurting you and is painful for you, it's a natural way of preserving yourself, your self-esteem, your personhood, even perhaps your religiosity, to move away from that world and find a place that's safe so that you can sort of heal yourself. So rebellion sometimes is a matter of self-preservation. Sometimes it's a way of achieving emotional health. If you are in a place which is emotionally dangerous to you and you want to become emotionally healthy, the first thing you do is sort of like sumeira ve'aseh tov. You have to move away from the negative environment to put yourself in a place where you can achieve emotional health. So if, God forbid, religious people have been abusive towards you, there's no way you're going to achieve emotional health by remaining in that abusive religious environment. You have to sort of move to a place that's at least neutral so that you can start working on yourself in a positive way. So if rejection is one of the biggest causes for people going off the derech, it follows that acceptance and love are one of the biggest ways of attracting people and perhaps healing or helping those who are on their way off the derech. I'd like to share another story with you, which Rabbi Riskin shared with me, which I found particularly interesting, which demonstrates this point. Rabbi Riskin said that he has a friend whose son gave him a real run for his money. He said he was a wonderful boy, intelligent and loving, but in his teens he was having a hard time and became very rebellious. He had dropped out of school and let his hair grow. The father was an outreach rabbi who had brought many people closer to Judaism, but he had been unsuccessful with his own son. The man worried about the impact it would have on his other children, and he told his wife, "We have to kick him out of the house." His wife said, "No, he's testing you. He wants to see who is more important, the community or your son. He's rebelling, but he's doing it inside the house. Don't push him away." Rabbi Riskin recounts, "That night, the distraught father was coming home from a lecture, and on the radio there was an interview. The person being interviewed was a professor with a name that woke him up. The professor's father had been a Dayan who had written a commentary on the Tosefta that was quite well known in religiously educated circles. The interviewer asked the professor, 'Why did you not Hebraicize your name? You have such an obviously Polish-Russian name. Why didn't you do it?' The professor said, 'I would never do that.' His whole voice changed. 'I had a father who was considered a great rabbi, and we always fought about Shabbos, Yom Kippur even, and he kicked me out of the house. He died. I don't know if the soul lives after life, but if his soul is still alive, he would love to know that I changed my name. But I want him to know, wherever he is, that he has a son with his name who eats on Yom Kippur.'" Rabbi Riskin's friend started to cry. He came home and woke up and told his wife, "I never want our son to say that about me. You were right." He then went to see a psychiatrist who told him, "Listen, I know you and I know your wife. Trust your son." The father did so. He relaxed his expectations, and things started to improve. Sometime later, the reason for the rebellion became clearer. The son left a note on his father's pillow that read, "Dear father, we are both blind. You don't always see how much I have done for you, and I don't always see how much you taught me. But you think I took the tablets and I just threw them to the ground. That's not what happened. They were too heavy, and they simply dropped from my hands." This story, I think, is a very telling one. We often misread or misinterpret the behavior of people in our life, perhaps particularly our children. And when it comes to the issue of people going off the derech, our children in particular perhaps going off the derech, that love and acceptance can be a very important thing. Sometimes we feel that rejection sends the message that what is happening is unacceptable. And perhaps that will preserve some sort of commitment. But the truth is that if we've done the job that we should have done in terms of raising our kids with their Yiddishkeit, we won't need rejection to help keep them committed to Judaism. And if we haven't, the rejection won't really work. So having a loving attitude through what can be particularly difficult or challenging times can be one of the most important ways of either preventing children or people from going off the derech, or helping them to come back if they've already started to do so. It's not very easy to maintain that attitude. It requires really not being judgmental in the first place, which is a very, very difficult thing to do when Judaism and observant life is so important to us. But if we think about it, there are times which we are not so judgmental with people. If you think, for example, of someone who has gone through the Holocaust, for example, there are people who went through really such horrific experiences that they lost faith altogether. And we have a very hard time judging those people. We would never think if somebody lost complete faith in God after that, well, you know, he really shouldn't have. And would God expect of a man who went through the Holocaust and lost all faith to, for example, daven with real kavana, or keep Shabbos, you know, with a real passion? It's hard to imagine that someone in that place, that God's expectations of him would be the same as they would be as someone who never had those sorts of negative experiences. The same is true of many of these people who have gone off the derech. Their experiences have been so negative, so painful, it's hard to imagine that God would really expect the same of them that he would of those who have had perhaps very positive or passionate experiences. However it is that we can reach an attitude which is accepting and loving and not judgmental, that really is particularly helpful in, first of all, helping people not go off the derech in the first place and helping them then to return. That acceptance and lack of judgment, or rather, let's put in the negative, the attitude of rejection that we often find towards individuals is often the case, or is often problematic, also when it happens on the communal level. There are a significant majority of people who responded to the website who said that their communities had negative attitudes both to people who were more religious and less religious than themselves, And particularly telling, nobody seemed to feel that their communities had a positive attitude to people who were either more religious or less religious than themselves. And that, in a vacuum, is not all that important, except when asked whether or not those negative attitudes caused them to respect their own community less, the vast majority of people said that it did. And when asked if those negative attitudes caused them to move away from their communities, the vast majority of people said that it did. Now, it might seem sort of strange. I mean, what difference does it really make if we have negative attitudes or rejecting attitudes towards other communities? And there is very good reason for that, particularly that when we have a negative attitude towards everyone to the right and everyone to the left, and this, I think, sort of happens across the board. It's not just in modern Orthodox or in the yeshivish world. It seems like every community, wherever you are, what you're doing is right and everyone else is wrong. So your way is the way to go. What that does is it creates an attitude that there's one right way to be from, namely your way, whatever your particular way is. And that is very problematic when it comes to children, because really we say, chinuch l'nar al pi darko, you should teach a child according to his way, and his way might not be your way. You might be more in a modern Orthodox world, and he might need to go more on a yeshivish sort of path, or there might be people in the more yeshivish path or the more Haredi path whose children need to have a little bit more options to go the other way, and when they don't, it creates great problems. I know somebody who very much wanted to, he was from the modern Orthodox world, very much wanted to get smicha. It was really his derech, and had he gotten smicha, he would have made an excellent rav. Really had a great character, a great passion for Judaism. His parents were very much against this. They were modern Orthodox. They were professional. They wanted their son to be professional. They very much discouraged him and strongly from pursuing that kind of path. What ended up happening was he sort of floundered around for a long time. Professionally, he did not get smicha, nor did he become a professional. First he was a bartender, and then he was a store manager, and then he became a plumber for a little while. Not that there's anything wrong with any of these things if that's what you want to do. But he ended up sort of doing these things because there was nothing else in particular that he really wanted to do. What he wanted to do was not open to him because it was unacceptable. In the end, he ended up going off the derech also and became involved in drugs as well, which is a whole other story in and of itself. But his being unable to find the path that was right for him really ended him up in a place that was not really good for him at all, not well suited to him. He ended up being in high tech, like many other people, I guess, who perhaps didn't find their place. But really, he came from sort of like a modern Orthodox world, which you would think would be more tolerant, in fact, than it was. This sort of the sort of limitations that our negative attitudes towards other communities creates can sometimes cause a lot of anger and frustration, surprisingly so. One person who I mentioned in the book was in yeshiva, and in yeshiva in Israel, in seminary in Israel, and she was told that if she found her potential in honesty and intelligence, she would see that a black hat life was the one that would be right for her. And I include a journal entry here from this girl, which I'd like to share a piece of it with you. She in her journal wrote the following. A black hat life is the only one that is right for me. There are no other options. That's the worst thing, to forget that there were and are other options, to forget that it's an active choice where you go. For me, the active choice is essential. Never to feel that I've simply been blindly led by others who forgot the other options, unless I make a conscious, independent choice to forget them. I want to roll along the tracks and remember the destination and cause. Otherwise, I will become like a train, going on the same path, at the same speed, headed to the same destination, every 5 minutes, with no change, no life, a limp, dead robot with no growth and no consideration for the value of happiness and ability to use what God gave us. That's what I'm most scared of, becoming a me I would hate without realizing it, a me that is antithetical to all I stand for, a me that forgets the options, the destination, the why, the opportunity, the gift for happiness. Being told that a black hat life is all you're good for, that anything else would be selling yourself short, that your honesty and intelligence would not exist truly or would be deprived if you didn't live that lifestyle, is being told to forget the options. It is seeing one way, one track, and ironically can make you feel guilty for not getting on the train when in fact it's against you to buy the ticket. It's a little bit extreme, and that journal entry actually goes on a little bit, and it gets more and more extreme as it goes on. But it can kind of show you how angering a simple, innocent comment can be. A black cat life is the only one that's right for you. Doesn't seem like it would be such a problematic comment coming from a rav in a seminary, particularly if it's a black hat seminary, but it created great anger and resentment because it was too limiting for this particular girl. Now, had this been the derech that was right for this girl, perhaps it wouldn't have been limiting, and perhaps it would have been, in fact, been a very inspiring comment. But it was the wrong comment made to the wrong person. And these comments are probably made all the time, not necessarily from the yeshivish world, again, in the modern Orthodox world, really across the spectrum, whenever it is that we're making limiting or denigrating comments towards other communities, it creates situations which are problematic, particularly because they stifle our children or stifle people into boxes that they might not fit in. This kind of rejecting attitude is problematic even when it comes to non-observant people. Sometimes we have rejecting attitudes towards the non-observant as a means of, or in the hopes of, protecting our children from sort of crossing the line and going over. But often it can backfire. One girl, a teenager, wrote on a website, not mine, on another website. She sort of explains why this is true. She says, she stopped keeping Shabbos. And she explains, well, when I decided to do it, I figured I would feel like a bum. Because that's the only thing they taught us in school about being religious, that those who don't are bums, basically. But after I did it, I didn't feel like a bum. I felt like me. So obviously, there's no difference between someone who keeps Shabbos and someone who doesn't, except one is religious and one is not. So why should I be religious, I figured? Like, what's the point? I think it's a very telling comment. Obviously, she was told, or she heard throughout her life, very negative attitudes and perhaps stereotypes about non-observant people, which she found not to be true. It's sort of like we're told with Adam and Chava in the Garden of Eden that Chava sort of like drew the line like a little bit farther than she should, and she told the snake, I'm not even allowed to touch the tree. And the snake, that kind of opened the door then for the snake to say, well, you're not allowed to touch the tree even, but I'm touching the tree and I'm okay, so obviously you can touch the tree and you'll be fine too. So she heard whatever she heard about people not keeping Shabbos, and when she didn't keep Shabbos, she thought, well, it's no big deal. And it enabled her, actually, to go off the derech a lot easier. So this attitude, these attitudes, when they're rejecting either towards individuals, our children, or towards communities on the communal level, whether it be religious communities or not religious communities, they're very, very problematic. Sometimes they're very innocent comments that are made. Surely no parent really chooses consciously to reject his child. No one wants to do that. But when it happens, or more importantly, when it's perceived to have happened, which is really all that matters, not the reality but the perception of it, it can lead people away. I was lucky enough to interview Rabbi Jonathan Sacks in researching this book, and he said something which sums this particular issue up very nicely. He said, am I supposed to live with a Judaism that is only as big as one particular group in Borough Park? Judaism is bigger than Borough Park. It is bigger than Bnei Brak. It is bigger than Stanford Hill. It is huge. Go and stand in the Kotel, and you will see people who have come together to Israel from 103 different countries, speaking 82 different languages. You will see the walls of Jerusalem, which have been destroyed so many times and rebuilt by the next conqueror. If you look at the old walls, at the walls of the old city, you will see that they are all higgledy-piggledy. Sitting next to each other are stones from all sorts of periods that are all jumbled together. We live in that kind of time. Judaism is 4,000 years. No other culture, maybe with the possible exception of the Chinese, has a time span like that. No other culture, without any exception, has the kind of geographical and cultural and anthropological diversity that Judaism has. Judaism is big, and if you were to hear someone making it small, then you have to know that Judaism is bigger than that. Our kids want something that is big, that gives them room to grow. And I think that basically sums it up very nicely. We are, as a people, meant to be a light unto the nations, but we can't be a light unto the nations if we're not a light unto ourselves. And as long as our children and people in our community, young or old, young or older, are going off the derech and moving away from us and our communities and our way of life, it indicates that there's really a lot more that we can be doing and should be doing to help live the kind of attractive Judaism that draws them close. It's my hope that this book will be one step on that journey, and I'm sure that we can all, with a little bit of perhaps openness and greater understanding, help to take the steps to make that happen. So I'll be happy to answer any questions if anyone has, and yeah.
I don't think there's anyone in this room who hasn't experienced rejection on some level. And also, we all have seen things that really disgust us about other people's co-living. Yet, we're all still here. So, first, have you made any attempts to talk to some people who, and understand what may be the difference between those who is really rejection the only thing, or perhaps the people who say, I've had a very positive experience in other facets that, you know, that she was, for example, the role you spoke about in the seventh grade and, you know, the teacher was loving it. I mean, everyone has had a teacher who's an idiot. And she may have had 10 other stories, but for example, it wasn't her parents, but unless she had bad parents. So that would lead me to think maybe there was some other void as well, and the rejection has to combine with something.
Right. Okay, so in the book I discuss at least 20 different reasons that people go off the derech. And oftentimes it's not just one thing, it's many things. It could be, for example, like this David fellow who I interviewed. Rejection was really the main issue, but there were like 30 different stories of rejection. So when you put it together, yes, rejection can be enough. I think it's important to understand that you're right. Often there are multiple experiences that sort of come together to create a negative feeling about observant people and observant life. Also, there are two other factors that come into play. One is, you know, when you experience rejection as an adult, it's a very different thing than when you experience it as a child. You know, when your self-esteem is well-formed and someone rejects you or someone says something stupid, you can handle that a lot better than if you're 7, 8, 13, 14, and you really don't have the same sense of self. So age, I think, has something to do with it. And personality, I think, also has a lot to do with it. You know, some people are more greatly affected by experiences like rejection than other people are. For example, you know, one person cannot have his questions answered, let's say, about Judaism. And he might not be particularly intellectual in nature, so it doesn't affect his belief or his faith or his observant life very much. Another person who's very intellectual by nature, if he doesn't have his questions answered, it perhaps can cause him to go off the derech. So I think age is a factor, I think personality is a factor, and I think the prevalence of experiences is also a factor. If you experience rejection over and over and over again, then you basically learn that religion is about rejection, it's about negative feelings, and perhaps that can be enough to cause you to go off the derech. But in general, there are many different causes, and oftentimes in people's lives you do find that there's more than one at play. And that's why it takes a whole book to sort of address the issue as opposed to one lecture. Yeah.
How do the people who say rejection is their reason deal with, I think, matters of faith? Like, you know, okay, my friend is teaching me to be jurist, but, you know, I still believe in God, and it's hard if everyone wants to live a certain life. Or do they kind of repress that side?
I don't know that there's a lot of consciousness a lot of times about exactly what it is that's going on. Like this David guy whose story I shared with you, you know, he didn't come out and say ever, you know, I went off the derech because of rejection. It's a lot of times very much under the surface, and it takes a lot of thought and self-awareness to sort of dig up these reasons and be aware of them. Sorry, I lost my train of thought for a second there. What was your question again?
How do you deal with that faith and, you know?
Okay, so I think primarily people are motivated much more by emotional sorts of experiences than intellectual ones. With the exception of there are people who are true truth seekers, who are very intellectual by nature, and who have the ability to sort of override negative experiences with what they intellectually believe. And perhaps that's an ideal. But in real life, for most people, emotions are much stronger motivators than dry intellectual ideas are. You know, when you meet someone who you love, you know, or someone who inspires you, you know, it's easier to be inspired by people and the excitement in their voice than it is to be inspired by a line that you read in a book, let's say. I think that's just human nature. And so most people, it seems, are affected more either by negative experiences or positive experiences versus positive or negative intellectual ideas. My guess is I think that's just human nature and just the way it is. Whether or not it should be that way is a different story, but that's what I found.
when you talk about rejection, it seems that the Orthodox community begins to reject someone who is starting to leave. That you know, it's sort of like the loss builds up on a lower path. But there seems to be something that's starting it off. That doesn't seem like the rejection is something that may worsen the situation. But something, well, what's causing them to have behaviors and feelings that then the community will reject them for? Why is it that there are some families that actually now foreclose this children, and other families, the kids are all over the place. What makes the kids have that kind of feelings and doing activities that will have the response of the community, the family, and the school to reject them?
You mean the children, what is making them do something which is unacceptable in the first place?
There are kids in the school and the family that go to a movie is not so accepting. And then they're being, they're rejected because they're rejected because they don't want to see them. Well, you're really doing the best activity that's causing them to reject you. Something's getting the train going.
Okay, so I think there's a number of things. In the first place, there could be issues like, let's say, issues of shalom bayit or familial problems at home that causes acting out, so that these kinds of, let's call them deviant is a very strong word, but let's call them deviant or, deviant behaviors compared to the societal norm, whatever that might be, as strict or as lenient as it is. There could be things like that that cause acting out. On the other hand, there could be things like just simple personality. For example, I mentioned in the book Chaim Potok. Okay, now Chaim Potok liked to paint. His father considered painting a goyish activity. Now, is there anything inherently wrong with painting? I don't know. I personally don't think so. Chaim Potok's father seems to have thought that there was something inherently un-Jewish about it. He was a creative guy. It happened to be that in the society and in the home that he was born into, that was deviant behavior. I don't know that you could say he was acting out when he wanted to paint. It happened to be that in comparison to the world that he happened to be a part of, this was deviant. I would call it his personality. I wouldn't say it was a particularly acting out. So, it really depends. This is why this is as complex an issue as it is. Sometimes these kinds of behaviors might be acting out on the part of a child, in which case you have to say, why is the child acting out in the first place? And the answer could be he's having issues at home. The answer could be maybe he's in an environment that's too restrictive for him. Or maybe his personality just needs to explore things which happen to be unacceptable in the world that he's in. I spoke to one psychologist who said that he has spoken to many kids who have gone off the derech, who, if they had gone to a different school, simply a different school, they probably wouldn't have gone off the derech. There was nothing inherent about what was going on in their home life that would have created issues for them, but they were in a world that was just ill-suited for who they were. It was just the wrong derech for them. So rather than, choosing a different derech, they just chose to go off altogether. Not chose as consciously as a conscious choice, but they ended up going off the derech altogether. So I hope that answers your question a little. Yeah.
I think a lot of times what we call going off the derech is already the jump that is referring to is already doing something that very consciously appears that they've left or leave the bowl. As opposed to the cracks, these small things under the surface that either we don't see or get ignored. Or, we blind ourselves if we don't want to see them. And most of the cases that I've encountered are where people just haven't done what they call a reality check, whether it's the educators in the school or the parents. They don't do reality checks on where the child or teenager is at a given point. Or for what reason. But if someone said they played and saw this movie, it may be because they're already some major rebellious things, something that they need to be taught to. But someone like that girl that you referred to in the Sabbath, so that was probably a classic example of the Sabbath syndrome there. Mm-hmm. She was being told to watch that movie, you've done something horribly terrible.
Right.
So she feel very terrible about it.
Right.
And so go on to do something else. So a reality check, once you can tell by a teacher, why she would assume that.
A psychologist that I spoke to said that, you know, the same issue in two different families can have two completely different results. You know, in one, let's say a child doesn't want to wear a black hat and the parent wants him to, in one family it'll be a blip on the radar screen, and in another it'll be Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And it all depends on how it's related to and how it's dealt with when it happens. So yeah, sometimes these things are small things, but they can turn into big things if we don't address them and deal with them properly. You had a question?
You sort of rejected that when you think about so believing God, believing the truth of Jesus. It's not really the issue. Like so many things in the school establishment, you've got someone said that you're going to walk and left because you believe God and believe God. I find this interesting.
Will people go off the derech even if they believe?
So this person is a jerk. If you really believe God,
First of all, a lot of them might not be on the derech to start with. I mean, that's a good point, and I think that's true. You know, I think far fewer of us are religious in the true sense than it might appear. Some of these people are not really on the derech to begin with. Having said that, you know, I think when, as a young child or as a teenager or even as a person in your 20s, if you perpetually experience things like this, first of all, I think you can start to question really if Judaism is the truth to begin with. Because if something is true and something is so great, you know, Daracher, Darche Noam, if it's that great, you know, you should see it. It should translate into life. And if it doesn't translate into life, it makes sense to question really what good is it. So maybe the emotional experiences begin to affect the intellectual belief. And if they don't affect the intellectual belief, you know, I mean, Torah really is about how it's lived here on earth. You know, we say, there's that famous Gemara about Torah lo b'shamayim hi. And I kind of understand Torah lo b'shamayim hi as really, you know, Torah is about the world that we create. I think Rabbi Sachs actually said Judaism is just as much about the world that we create for God here on earth as it is the world that God creates for us in heaven. And, you know, we sort of have the responsibility of translating Judaism into real life. And that's part of the beauty of Judaism and part of its greatness. We translate it into the world and give our children a place which is supposed to be better and inspiring. When they see a Jewish world which is really uninspiring or painful, even worse, over and over and over again, painful, they have good cause to question whether or not it's true. And even if it is true, who cares? You know, if it's going to hurt you over and over again, and again, you know, as an adult, you might experience something and it can wash off your back. As a teenager, you know, or as a young child, or as a person in your 20s, maybe not so much. So I think these things are very, very significant. Even when you might have a strong belief, you can start to lose it, or you can start to not care just because it's too hard or too painful. At least that's what I found with the people I spoke to. Yeah. In terms of the reasons why they might go off? I didn't look specifically at those differences. What I tried to do was isolate the general principles that would be true across cultural divide and across the religious spectrum. I did speak to people who came from Baal Tshuva families, modern Orthodox, Yeshivish, and Hasidic. So I tried to hit the whole spectrum, and people who responded to the web survey also represent the whole spectrum of religiosity.
Was it just America or
American? The web survey was somewhat of a mix, but mostly America, and the Rebbeim that I spoke to were both in America and in Israel. Most of the people who had actually gone off the derech were in America. But, for example, you know, again, I tried to isolate the principles that would be true both here and there. So, I hope the answer is in the book somewhere. Yeah.
Speaking of language, going off the derech, but in fact, everything you're saying is challenging that terminology.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're actually challenging this whole notion of, well, what do you know exactly what the derech is, or defining the derech, how narrow or wide is it, and what's going on. What that further seems to suggest is that there might be a certain selection bias, in the sense that what we're looking at is really a continuum of decreased commitment to observance. And exactly what constitutes on or off the derrick is a pretty, so if you look at people who rebel, really might talk. But my experience, you go to American college campuses, is much more of another place in the professional world, is a general drift, which doesn't seem to be part of the same sort of psychological dynamic, but might be sort of the more fundamental, maybe movement as well.
You mean it's a slower sort of phenomenon where they just slowly move away as opposed to...
The question is, what is the fact that a person still is considered to be moving to the fold doesn't mean that they have not significantly simply become less observant,
right,
less committed, or what have you.
Right.
And when exactly that person is true, the community sets a certain boundaries. But the truth is that it's a much vaguer...
Yeah.
The focus precisely people being on the derrick or off the derrick. However you define it in the most liberal way, it seems sort of obscures
the real issue.
That whole continuum. So much challenging for the language to use when that's really...
Well, first of all, I personally hate the term off the derrick. It's very ironic that I've titled my book Off the Derrick. I don't like the term at all. I don't really understand what it means. In fact, starting to do the research for this, I'm like, well, what is the derrick? How am I supposed to do research for this book? So I ended up using, halachic observance of Shabbos and Kashrut when I looked at, when I chose my population to sort of survey. Because I had to choose something, right? So I chose that. But you're right, there is a continuum. It's the lines are not so clear-cut at all. We like to define people as on or off in stark ways because it kind of, I guess it makes life easier for us. But in the religious world, there are people who, I call them in the book, they're internally off the derech. You don't see it in their behavior. It hasn't translated in their behavior. Maybe because their feelings are not extreme enough. Maybe because they haven't had the opportunity to go off the derech. Maybe because they're not brave enough to go off the, for whatever reason, they're in the religious world, but they're not really connected or committed to it the way you would think they should be. So I call the people who have gone off the derrick the tip of the iceberg. They're what you see, because it's translated in their behavior. But you're right, there's unfortunately many people whose their hearts are not in it, their souls are not in it, they're kind of going through the motions. And if they're not off the derech internally themselves, their children very well may be, their grandchildren very well may be. And you often see it translates to the next generation. Because what you feel, if you feel it passionately, chances are your children will feel it passionately. And if you don't, chances are your children won't either. So, I mean, you're right. You're right. Yeah.
I'd just like to supplement that your book, and the pasuk in the Talmud, this is Tachta Shaloh Abashtem Hashem Hashem Yisim Kol. And you find there are some people for whom mitzvot are a burden and a problem, and for others for whom it's an opportunity.
Yeah.
I grew up in a home in which mitzvot are always a burden, then it would start becoming lax and we could throw away altogether.
Yeah.
Because that's a different kind of rejection. In other words, basically, what's the point of all of this?
Yeah.
Just to have a burden upon me, or is it something that gives me something? A family that doesn't see Zmirot and Shabbat. A family where the father of protection walks into shul like half an hour later on Shabbat morning is telling his kids, I really don't like this too much, but I've got to do it.
Right.
And that message gets across.
Yeah, I know somebody who, whose kid was complaining about davening, who said, what do you think? You think I like davening? We don't like davening. You just gotta do it. I mean, look, passion translates. If you feel joy, that joy is contagious. If you feel like it's a burden, the feeling of burden is contagious. So, let me get a lady for a second. Yeah.
I'm curious to know. Given the fact that our society is a conservative and we have a tendency to keep our hot problems in the park, A, is your book making an impact as we work making an impact on establishing leadership for rabbis, educators, etc. And I'm not looking at last week or a year ago, but that's part of the question.
Okay.
And are you getting to the leadership? Like, are they, do you find that they're listening and internalization, getting to the conventions, etc., in order to make a real impact? Because a group of 50 or 100 in schools are pretty much the rest of your life.
Right.
So not going to make a real impact.
Right. Right. Well, first of all, the book came out a month ago. I think it's making a bigger impact in the amount of time that it's been out than really anybody anticipated that it would. People seem to be very interested in it, thankfully. And I think, you know, some of the endorsements that I got indicate that really the leadership is behind it. But I have to tell you personally that if I could speak to one parent and make an impact in terms of how a parent relates to a child, to me that's a lot more meaningful than the leadership, because the truth is that these issues begin not up there, but at home, on the ground level. And when, first of all, parents make the biggest impact on children, and when parents can do a good job of inspiring their children with Yiddishkeit and at least avoiding some of the pitfalls, that is a lot more meaningful and a lot more impactful than if a rav in a shul, you know, gleans something from this work that enables him to be a better leader. That's important too, but there's nothing that's as important as the impact that parents make on kids. So. Well, about a third of the book deals with educational issues, because the intellectual part of belief does play an important role on how we feel about Yiddishkeit and our commitment to it. But these emotional sorts of experiences, and really the biggest part, and where it makes the biggest impact, really is with parents, and that's what most of the book focuses on. I think that is the most important thing. So this is the most important group, really, not the leadership. If they are behind it, then hopefully I'll have more speaking engagements and I can speak to more people like you. That's important. Yeah.
On this discussion of Simcha Shal Mitzvah, I read in the Jewish Action, there was an article about Baal and Teshuva having a disproportional high, like the Baal and Teshuva are a disproportionately high dropout rate.
Uh-huh.
And just how did these two reconcile, assuming that Baal and Teshuva generally, as in my experience, do have not that someone who has been born from, but that Baal and Teshuva generally do have like a simple shal mitzvah that other people like look.
Right. I can only guess at to what some of the reasons might be, because I didn't look at that population in particular. I could just throw out some things off the top of my head which may or may not be true in any particular case. It could be that the enthusiasm is sort of too much for the kids. In other words, they expect maybe too much of their own children. Like they think, well, they're from in a particular way, so their kids now, they want them to take it to the next level, which maybe is not appropriate for their kids or difficult or too challenging for their kids. They might, in their enthusiasm, inadvertently impose observance on their children in a way that doesn't work for them. There's also some Baalei Teshuva who responded to the website who said some pretty surprising things, surprisingly negative things. They were not really happy with where they were in the religious Jewish world. They felt somewhat disillusioned, which makes sense. If you're a Baal Teshuva and you sort of come into the observant Jewish world with a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of passion, sometimes the reality that you find can be somewhat disappointing, and more so disappointing for the Baal Teshuva than for the person who perhaps was born into it and sort of slowly came to realize what the reality of observant life is. So some of these Baalei Teshuva who are still observant have negative feelings that they really can't do much about, because they're in the religious world, they are married, they have children, maybe they don't want to leave, maybe they even do want to leave, but they can't. And maybe you see that in the behavior of their kids. So, I mean, these are maybe a couple of different reasons that may be true. And in any particular situation, you know, I can't speak to any particular situation, so... Yeah.
You started off by saying that you're very interested in the truth that you mentioned that there was a time when there was a community of four women, and there was another community that was sort of turned around.
But I think that the question is whether in the vocal registration and reason, when that changed back then to now, it became rejection of the landscape present now. Different issues that make that change.
Right. Well, I think a big thing was the Enlightenment, which sort of really changed the reality of in the world altogether. That's a big historical difference between then and now, which I discuss in the book. Yeah. What I tried to do here, and obviously we can't go back 200 years ago and see what happened then. What I tried to do was sort of look at human nature and human experience, and try to identify the principles. So, for example, you know, I was asked if I looked at situations here or in America. For example, in America, or here, let's look at here, people say, well, people go off the derrick because of the army, you know, when they go to the army. It's not really the army that's the issue. It's something that's underlying the army that's the issue. In America, it might be university. What I tried to do was look not at the army or university, but at the issue that's underneath that, which in this society or that society might express itself differently here or there. But the principle is the principle. So, you know, my guess would be that people went off the derrick 200 years ago for the same reasons that I have in the book here. I can't know for sure, but I tried to make it as general as possible that the actual behaviors and the specifics of the behaviors might be different, but the principle, underlying principles are probably the same. Yeah. Right. Look, it's very difficult to answer that question because it really depends, I think, very much on who the individual child is, who the individual parent is, and to what extent the needs of the child are being met religiously and otherwise. I could say in general that I think a good general rule to go by is, you know, drawing lines, first of all, is different from having a negative attitude towards something. You know, you can draw a line and it can be a very healthy thing. But lines do need to move, I think, as children get older. Perhaps they need to become fewer, perhaps they need to become more broad. Very difficult to say, again, depending on the situation. But in general, I think when parents' behavior, whatever it may be, is creating a negative attitude toward observance in the child, that's a red flag. So if you're drawing lines and you're maintaining, your child seems to maintain a positive attitude towards Yiddishkeit and toward himself, his own self-esteem, your relationship, then your line drawing is being effective. If it's creating a negative attitude towards you, towards Yiddishkeit, there's something wrong somewhere, and maybe those lines need to be reconsidered. Maybe just the attitude with which those lines are drawn needs to be reconsidered. But that's the red flag sort of that something's going wrong. And I think much more important than the actual behavior of the child is the attitude of the child toward observance. If the attitude is positive, even if today he falters a little bit, tomorrow he'll probably come back to it. But if you get the behavior, but it comes with a negative attitude, the second he's out of your jurisdiction, chances are the attitude will remain and it'll pull him farther away. So I think maintaining the positive attitude is the most important thing, and you kind of have to watch your child for that. So, I mean, it's such a delicate, I mean, parenting is so difficult, but it's such a delicate thing it would be. I can't really say anything more specific than that, but there are people who are very well educated and have a lot of experience in these sorts of things. Basi Shaketa is sitting here. She runs SOFIA, School for Girls at Risk, works with therapists all the time. These are the kinds of people who really have the kind of experience to answer that kind of question a lot more effectively than I can only speak to the principles. Very hard to speak to the specifics. Maybe she can.
Maybe
you have
one last question.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask you, based on your research and your interviews, if you have any, if you can give us any pointers on things to look out for a child who might be showing signs of the obvious signs in the afternoon that are very clear, but the ones that are less obvious, if you have any pointers of things to watch out for and things that might be getting in the direction.
In terms of a child who's potentially going off the derech?
As parents here, what should we do with it? Very practical question.
That's a good question. That's a good question, not very easy to answer. I mean, again, I think the attitude is a very important thing. You know, behavior, you can keep the behavior in line. So looking at behavior is not necessarily as effective as sort of looking at the spirit behind it. But there are many sorts of, you know, I guess really opening, keeping open the lines of communication with your kids will enable them to share whatever positive or, more importantly, negative experiences they might have, which, you know, can tell you a little bit about what's going on or what direction things are moving in. So if you're open enough with your kids and your kids are open enough with you to just simply share their potentially negative experiences with them, which means there has to be sort of an open, non-judgmental atmosphere so that if they do have a gripe about this or that or they have been hurt by a particular situation, they can share that with you. I think that's one of the biggest preventers. If they have that good relationship with you, you'll hear what's going on, and they'll be able to tell you how they feel about things, and you can, more importantly, discuss it with them. So I would say that. I don't know if that's really a very helpful answer, but...
I really want to thank you for sharing.
Thank you. Yeah?
Really, sir.
Okay.